Okay, guys, so welcome to the Physio Plus Fitness podcast. I've got my regular co-host Glenn Robbins on the line with me, and our special guest today is Bart Dingenen. He's a physical therapist. He's done lots of research. We were just talking about that a second ago, over 30 papers. He's got a PhD, which focused on ACL injuries and chronic ankle instability, and his postdoctoral research focused really on the optimization of rehab of ACL injuries and running-related injuries, which is the topic that we're going to sort of talk mainly about today. We may stray off into other topics as we often do in these podcasts, but we'll try and keep to the running related injuries if we can. So welcome, Bart, to the podcast.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Glenn, for the invitation, for having me here today. It's a big honor to be on your podcast. If I see all the names in the list, all the speakers who have been invited already, I'm very happy to contribute to your podcast. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. So I thought we could maybe sort of, as a jumping off point, as I said, talk about running related injuries. And you did a paper which I think would be interesting to talk about as a starting point. So this was the subclassification of recreational runners with a running related injury based on running kinematics evaluated with a marker based 2D video analysis. So it's a long title to the paper, but it's really interesting. So could you maybe just describe what you talked about in the paper and then maybe what your findings were in that paper, and we can kind of go from there.
Sure. So this paper was published last year, 2020. And what we did actually was measuring, in this case, 53 recreational runners with all a running related injury. So it was not about only about the knee or the chin. It was a combination of different injuries of the lower extremity, running related injuries. It were both males and females, a combination in this group. But the reason I did this study was because in previous studies, often we consider injured runners being one homogeneous group with the same kinematic patterns, which we know actually also from other studies, this might be a oversimplification of reality. So even within a certain group of with a certain pathology or with even with a certain kinematic presentation, you do have variation within that group. That was the first maybe starting point of that study. So what we did actually, we measured 2D kinematics. So we first validated this methodology in previous studies, but we measured 2D kinematics with two iPads, one in the frontal view and one in the sagittal view. So different angles were then drawn on the sagittal and frontal viewpoints at initial contact, but also at mid-stance. So the question was then, if we have these angles at initial contact, at mid-stance, which we know from previous studies based on 3D analysis could be of interest, for example, hip adduction, for example, tibial inclination at initial contact, etc. Okay, if we have these angles, are there within this group of injured runners some patterns or some groups of individuals who might be related to each other or who might have similar kinematic presentations? So that was the first question. And we did this not by predefining, okay, this is the first group, this is the second group. No, we did this with a certain software package, a program, statistical program, where we, but it's not so important, I think, for today, but it was like a automatic process where at the end, the different angles were grouped. And at the end, we could identify how many subgroups were available in this whole group of injured runners. So, okay. So at the end, what we found was that there were two subgroups in this population. And then the second step was, okay, if we have these subgroups, how do they differ from each other? What are the specific characteristics of these two subgroups? So, based on the kinematics, subgroup one was mainly characterized by more foot inclination and more tibia inclination in the sagittal plane at initial contact. compared to subgroup two, who had more like a shorter step with less tibia inclination, less foot inclination, and at initial contact. And what was also specific for these subgroups was that the group who had more the tibia inclination, foot inclination, had also less hip adduction. So therefore, I called this first group more a sagittal plane dominant subgroup, while the second group, which was characterized by more hip adduction and less foot inclination, tibial inclination, I call this group more the frontal plane dominant group, okay? And so at the end, we came with these two subgroups. And the third step was then to identify, okay, which injuries do occur in these subgroups. Is it true that maybe knee pain or shin pain does occur more in subgroup one or in subgroup two, or whatever injury we might encounter in this study? That was the question. So interestingly, we found that similar kinematic presentations could be related to different injuries. And also the same injury, for example, patellofemoral pain, could be present in the different subgroups. So you could have the same injury, the same name of the pain or the clinical presentation, but this could be related to another kinematic presentation. So it's possible that a runner with patellofemoral pain might have a typical frontal plane dominant pattern with more hip adduction, for example. But it's also possible that the patient with patellofemoral pain has maybe not really that typical hip adduction pattern, but maybe more the long steps, the more foot inclination, more tibia inclination, maybe also more knee flexion in mid stance, you know, or a combination. So that was really interesting. Also, one other interesting finding was that the shin injuries. So I know clinically you can give a lot of names on these injuries like shin splints, medial tibial stress syndrome, etc. But the patients, we call it shin injuries, were typically found more in subgroup one. Remember, subgroup one was the group with more foot inclination, more tibial inclination, which from a mechanical point of view could make sense. That the loading could be more pronounced in specifically around the tibia at initial contact, but also at mid stance where there might be more knee flexion. So that was really an interesting finding. However, my conclusion was also that at the end, when we look at patterns or certain kinematic presentations, it's impossible to put people really into boxes and to say this is one group and everyone with this group is related to this kind of injury, everyone in the other group is related to another injury. That's too simplistic. So at the end, it comes down, and that's the main clinical message, to a individual interpretation within the whole story of the patient of the kinematic presentation. And we need then some insights in biomechanics, yes. We need also some insights in structural loading, but we also need insight in the whole story of the patient in front of us. Maybe the kinematic presentation doesn't matter at all. That's also a possible conclusion, you know. But one of the reasons we made these subgroups was based on the limitation that typically, we just consider everyone to be the same within one group. Maybe everyone with patellofemoral pain, we consider them to be patellofemoral pain patients with more hip adduction. But I can tell you, when you consider them each as an individual, you will find different presentations. And maybe the mean of the group of patients with patellofemoral pain will have more hip adduction. But this doesn't mean everyone has this presentation, and that's maybe the clue of the paper or the main message, that at the end it comes down to individual assessment, individual clinical reasoning, and putting your findings during your assessment in perspective of the findings of your patient history. That's the key point.
I think one of the interesting things when I was reading the paper was around looking at sort of clinical utility of 2D analysis, and you talked about in the paper that actually, you know, 2D analysis is still quite good at when you compare that to 3D analysis. Because I think obviously iPads is something that clinicians who are on the ground floor, you know, who are on treating patients, will have access to, whereas most people I know, I'm not sure I know anyone that's got access to 3D motion capture software. So that was quite interesting as well from that point of view.
Yeah, that's also during my different studies I've been producing. I've always thinking in my head, because I'm also working in clinic and for the moment mainly working in clinic, I'm always thinking, okay, so what question? What does it mean when I find these results? How can we move on in clinical practice? So this is also one of the reasons why I was developing these methods to have something which could be of value in clinic. Is it the best method? Maybe not. Probably we will find some better ways in the next couple of years. But I think that this is one of the steps we can do to make an evaluation more objective with some clinical friendly tools. I think as you mentioned, an iPad has really a high speed camera in there, so we can really make good images or good idea of what happens during movement. Although I also have to say that this is something I can say in a podcast, not in a study, that just focusing on a angle at a specific point in time is also something which has its limitations. Therefore, I mean that if you focus on just one point in time, for example, initial contact, you don't see what happens exactly before initial contact, and you also don't see what happens exactly after initial contact. You don't see how fast one is moving towards a certain angle. So you don't have a indication of the whole kinematic curve. So it has its limitations. And therefore, I think you have to be prudent, but with only focusing on a certain angle, because at the end, it's more complex than that. I'm the first to admit that. But, you know, in studies, you have to propose a method and you have to use a method, and each method has its advantages and its disadvantages, especially when you make it more easy to use. So again, there is also important to have a clear understanding of movement, of the running movement especially, and don't think that you can explain everything with drawing some angles and that's it. I mean, that's a oversimplification of reality.
Yeah, I think that's really what jumped out to me, Bart, is the clinical applicability of it, you know. So like 95% of the clinics I come across that are looking at runners, that's the sort of setup that they'll aspire to have, you know, the treadmill, the side view, the rear view, the front view on an iPad. And also I know we can, I mean, some people debate the validity of running analysis, but and it makes a small part of the whole picture, as you've said, like you're looking at training load, previous injury, you know, all these kind of factors. But it's really nice. I think every runner should, you know, we should look at them run, because that's the sport that they're doing, and it's easy enough to do in clinic. We don't always change things, but it's nice to be able to look at them run.
Absolutely.
And I think that also, as you mentioned, there's crossovers in these different presentations and patterns, but for new clinicians starting out, trying to specialize a little bit in observing runners, it's so complex that seeing a few patterns and seeing a few, you know, when you look at the mean of a certain presentation for, as you mentioned, shin pain, on the whole, generally having a higher inclination angle, little patterns like that are really like gold for clinicians that are starting out as well. You know, it might not be the same for every client they see, but it's nice to start to see certain patterns that they can recognize and see, is it valid to the presentation in front of them or not? You know, otherwise they're just looking at the whole runner and trying to spot things. And what I notice is they quite often overcomplicate things, try and look at, you know, rotations in the thorax or things going on in the pelvis when they're not covering some of the points that were mentioned in the study. So for me, that's what really jumped out, is it's research that kind of can be used by someone on the ground, you know, someone in a running clinic that's trying to see, you know, 4 or 5 runners a day and have it as a part of their caseload. Mm-hmm.
I think when working in clinic, you and by seeing more and more injured runners, you see patterns. And it's, I don't say that your clinical eye is always telling you the truth, but when you have a research background and you know the relationship between movement patterns and structural loading, doesn't mean pain, but structural loading, okay? And you can combine that with, or you can contribute here to literature that you can also, by using some methods, define some clusters, then we are a step further. Huh? I think the misinterpretation that's often used or often present also on social media these days, that we think far too often too black and white, you know, biomechanics doesn't matter, biomechanics do matter.
Yeah.
These things, I think all the factors can matter. Mm. And biomechanics can be one of the pieces of the puzzle. And for one person, it might be more relevant for one person, but not be that relevant. And that's also interesting. In 2019, we published in Sports Medicine a review on prospective risk factors from a biomechanical point of view for running injuries. And there also we pointed out different limitations of how we currently assess these risk factors. And I know limitations are not often read by a lot of people. People focus on the title and they read, there is no conclusive evidence that biomechanical risk factors are related to running injuries. But I think maybe we have to do a better job in the next couple of years in how we do these studies. It comes down to how to define our study group. Mostly these study groups are far too small to make these conclusions. We often focus on one certain angle. We often consider the whole group as one, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which at the end, of course, if you do this kind of analysis and some studies focus on one injury, some studies focus on all injuries together, yeah, at the end, of course, you will find nothing because you put everything on one piece. Yeah? So I think that's interesting also there to focus on that discussion of that paper, because there we identified some limitations of current approaches in literature. Mm. And to come back to your question of the clinical applicability of the visual and or 2D analysis, I think these days we have also another weapon in our clinical tool setting, let's say, are the wearables. Because with the iPads, we only see what happens. We only see kinematics. But these days, if we can combine this with wearables, and there are some good wearables on the market these days, then we can also define some or even have a bigger picture of our runner by also defining the kinetics, you know, the forces and the loading rates and ground contact times, flight times, etc., the relationships between them. We can have step rate calculations with wearables. We can have an indication of peak rates, but also of cumulative loading. You know, if you make them run, for example, 30 minutes outside in their natural environment, well, then we can have an even better picture of our runner from a kinetic point of view. So these wearables are also available these days, are developing very fast in the market. And I think when you can combine your patient story with your clinical tests, with your 2D analysis from a kinematic point of view with your kinetics, with your variables, including spatiotemporal characteristics. Well, I think you really have a nice picture of your runner. And personally, I don't believe you need a three-dimensional analysis, even if you would have access to that for a runner, because even there, we know that rotational movements are not really very reliable in even in three-dimensional analysis. So, and we don't look for 1 degree, you know? It's not like, can I see something? No, it's within the clinical reasoning, we try to find clear things. If they're not clear, not there. Simple. Huh? So that's how we can work in clinic. Okay.
You also start to get to a point where it takes so long to analyze the data and go through it all that it becomes almost unaffordable for the client, right? Like they're going to have to pay for extra long sessions. And I'm always thinking, you know, an hour, 2D, go through it with the screening, other tests that you do. It's nice and it's achievable and it's doable for a private patient that walks in off the street who's just a recreational runner, you know? So.
And at the end, the question is, will it change my clinical message?
Mm.
Probably not. Because the main things which might be clinical relevant could be quantified with the approaches we just mentioned. And because I know we in previous studies we combined 3D and 2D. We assessed a lot of athletes with 3D analysis, but at the end, the clinical message for the patient is, in my point of view, not really different than. Of course, when you have also force plate, etc., you have more data. But the clinical message for the patient, I'm not sure whether that's totally different. Mm. Where for a runner now, for the basic things you want to take it in your story or in your message for the patient, I think it's not really different.
Yeah, and I think it was fascinating to think about when you're talking about the kinetics versus the kinematics. And in your study, obviously it'd be interesting to see those patients who were who had the same group, so they were in the same group but they had different injuries, for example, to see what their kinetics would be, to see whether their kinetics would be different or the same. Because then you might find that, like you said, if someone's just seeing the picture of what they're doing at that time, you can't tell, okay, where are they absorbing the load? Are they
absolutely.
Do they look like they're absorbing the load well? Do they look like they're really not absorbing the load well? And if so, kinetically, you would obviously see, or you should see, a difference there, which then you could look at and go, well, okay, if we then stratify the groups again into the kinetics, do the people who have both similar kinetics and kinematics, do they then have more similar injuries, or actually is it still different? And then I think obviously the big question then becomes, what do you do about it? How do you change? Can you change kinematics, for example? Should you change it? Will that then in turn change kinetics? That's where we get into this minefield of all these different things and what you do.
I definitely think it would be interesting, but still, I don't think we will find then more clear subgroups, because that's what you also mentioned. The question is, and that's based on the patient story, does it really matter? If you have one patient with a certain pattern who made a big training error just before the injury happened, maybe it's just because of the training error. Maybe, from a clinical point of view then. It's always difficult to answer the question, why does this runner develop the injury? I know we cannot say that, but from a clinical point of view, we have to make some conclusions. We have to move on, okay? And if you find, based on the patient history, that actually the one thing that has been changed is mainly training load, could be volume, could be intensity, could be frequency, whatever. Maybe then the mechanics doesn't matter so much in this case. While in the other case, where there is nothing like a training error, etc., and maybe this runner has struggled with maybe last year patellofemoral pain, maybe the year before, gluteal tendinopathy, etc. Maybe we have more arguments to say that it could be interesting to consider the mechanics. So it's related to each other, of course. And then it's very really interesting to see the development of, for example, the wearables, where we can also have an indication of cumulative loading and not only of peak loading, etc. So it really becomes fascinating to see these days to work in clinic. It doesn't mean it's easy, not at all. But it gives us more insights.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that often is missed as well. If people are very much into the running analysis and they come in and they want to go through that, and, you know, you could have two, I always use an example, you could have two runners side by side. One of them, you know, however we may quantify a great running technique, you know, a high step rate, not a very large overstride, those kind of similarities. Mm-hmm. But they've gone from, you know, 2-3 runs a week to 6.
Yes.
Versus someone that's got what we might perceive as, you know, not such an optimal running style, but they've been just keeping nice and standard at 3 runs, 2 strength training, 2 recovery days. Mm-hmm. The runner that spiked his training loads probably got the higher risk, right? So the running analysis there, you have to, like you say, you have to look at it with the individual and what they've done, what they've changed prior to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that gets missed a lot as well. You know, people will focus, like you say, on one area or the other. Yeah. When someone could turn up and say, yeah, well, I've just signed up to a marathon and I've doubled my volume. Yeah. That's going to be more of their issue rather than the way they're running at that time, right? So
yeah, absolutely. It's also when I'm teaching courses, that's one of my key points, to look at what I call a multidimensional view at our patients. Maybe some people think because I've been doing some biomechanical studies that I'm only looking at biomechanical issues, but that's totally not true. And in a study, you cannot assess everything. That's simple, the truth. But when working in clinic, it's totally different, because you have to assess your patient from different perspectives. It could be perfectly that training load maybe is not the issue. Maybe biomechanics is not the issue. Maybe it's because of general health issues, maybe lack of sleep, maybe psychological issues, etc. Then these foundations are the first steps to take, and not at all maybe muscle strength, maybe not at all my hip adduction. Maybe it's the lack of recovery, maybe it's the lack of sleep, maybe the psychological stress, etc. Maybe it's nutrition, or maybe it's some other issues related to systemic issues related to, for example, a tendinopathy. So then we are talking about multidimensional clinical reasoning. And then, of course, your clinical reasoning when you just think about mechanics is too simplistic. And that's when I'm teaching courses, that's also always my goal, to make it clear to clinicians that it's not as simple and not as black as white as we might think, or maybe as we might first have learned, or maybe as we read in some studies. In clinical reasoning, it's really multidimensional framework that we have to use, and that's the complexity we are facing with.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so difficult, I think, for guys like yourself, Bart, and for other people who do research, because the whole kind of N equals one is a very easy thing to say as a clinician, but it is there. Like you know, within every, you know, I did a talk today at work, actually a presentation on subacromial pain syndrome. And I was just saying that, you know, the sub classifications or the differences you can have of someone with that type of condition is huge. Like, you know, all the same things in terms of, you know, lifestyle factors, medical health issues, loading, if they're doing sports, etc. And to have a group of 50 subacromial pain patients or 50 runners, and to have, you know, let's say in runners, patellofemoral pain syndrome or patellofemoral pain problems, you know, within that group of 50, you're going to have 50 different people that all have their individual different Absolutely. Problems. And so it's very difficult with that research. So I guess the question that, you know, and I think we talked about this on one of the previous podcasts with Greg Lehman, actually, about his fascination is kind of, it's when do you intervene? You know, when do you need to get someone stronger, for example? When do you need to change someone's running style, for example? Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of fascinating thing. And that's so individual. But for sort of physios out there, what's your thought process around that? So when do you think, if a runner comes in to see you in clinic, what's a typical situation where you might say, actually, this runner, I think it is relevant that we make them stronger, or it is relevant that we work on the kinematics, or work on maybe, you know, gait style or patterns of running, if that makes sense?
Yeah. The very good question, the $1 million question, of course, for other clinicians. Huh? And first of all, I agree that from a research point of view, it's very, very difficult to answer these questions. Because in studies, we, at least that's how in the past was more and more done, that we tend to focus on one certain kind of group with exclusion and inclusion criteria. In intervention studies, we give them all the same, while, as you mentioned, we know that not everyone needs strengthening, or not everyone is maybe weaker, and maybe those in the group who are stronger, of course, they have less profit of strength training, probably. Eh? So you have different profiles in the group to make that clear. Eh? So giving them just one intervention for everyone the same, by definition, it will you give only average results, because you give something which might be appropriate for one person, but probably not for the other person, or not as much appropriate as for the other person. And that's the reason why there is a tendency to go, again, more to case studies, more to case series. I agree, based on the, we all know, systematic reviews, etc., meta-analysis are on top. But from a clinical point of view, working daily with clinical patients, I'm not sure whether that's the only way to look at research. I think there is very, very valuable work out there also when, and also for clinicians, in very informative work, when you look at N equals one. And I think this will be done more and more in the next couple of years to assess the multidimensional aspects of the patient, and then maybe tend to see some profiles of patients. But again, this can be very individual. But to answer your question, how do I work? Well, I first start with a clear history of the. I listen to the patient. And listening to the patient means not only asking these very close questions, but really giving them the opportunity to give their story, you know, and also listening to other factors than just the injury. What is the context? Why did I run? What is the motivation? What are the beliefs? What does running mean for them? Okay, what does the injury mean for them? Etc. Are there any psychosocial issues involved? Maybe nutrition factors involved, maybe hormonal issues in the female athletes, training load issues, etc. Systemic conditions which might be relevant for example, tendinopathy, for example, lifestyle factors, etc. All these factors, I mean, you try to make a profile of your athlete or your patient in front of you. That's one. And then you also want to make a kind of a profile of your patient based on your clinical examination. And yes, I mean, that's how I work. And I don't think there's a golden way to work or a best possible way to work. But that's how I think it's achievable in clinic, is to, based on the story, maybe to give an example, let's say you have an ACL patient 3 years ago, and it's very clear based on the story of the patient that since then he had some when he returned back to sports or running, he had anterior knee pain. Okay. Well, then it could be of interest, of course, to also check quadriceps strength, calf strength, etc. Based on the fact that we know, by definition, there is, at least in the early phases of the rehab, but also for most patients, even after return to sport, based on literature, there is weakness in these muscles. Okay. So that then you could have some clear reasons to think about muscle strength, for example. But sometimes it's really clear on the story that they have done really consistent strength training. They have done really consistent training load, etc. They didn't make any errors over there. They sleep very well. They are top athletes, but still they struggle with injuries, for example. Well, then you look, okay, what else can we offer? And in this case of a patient, it might be of interest to essentially look at the biomechanics, you know. But also there in your clinical examination, you at least that's what I do. I try to make a profile over there, and that's also the truth. I think then also clinical experience comes in, because best practice is not only doing something what research indicates. It's combining that information with our clinical experience and with the context of the patient. That's high value clinical work, in my opinion. Not only in my opinion, that's how it's defined. Okay. So, yes, clinical experience is also there important, I think, to know what maybe could be more relevant for one person and what could be more less relevant for the other person. And maybe in the future, we might have better prediction rules to help us out. But for the moment, we don't have these, at least as far as I know. To have strong prediction rules from a multidimensional clinical reasoning perspective. That's a little bit how I approach the problem over here.
I think what's interesting there is it sort of illustrates why some clinicians may struggle, because you have to have skills in multiple areas, right? So the way I always talk about it is you need to have three hats. You have to have your physio hat. So you have to assess the problem in front of you and give a diagnosis. You have to have like a rehab, strength and conditioning kind of hat to guide them if they need it there. And then the running analysis, the biomechanics kind of skill as well. And all of these take time to develop in the context of a runner or an ACL specifically, mm-hmm. and experience, like you say. So it's hard for people to take them from point A to successful return into running if there is a little bit of input from each of these areas that they need to be skilled in managing. So that's certainly why people find it challenging, you know, in both of those areas you mentioned. I think that's relevant, ACL and running, looking at recreational runners as well. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to highlight that. So, you know, I work very similar to how you've just explained, but if people are just starting out, this is why I always enjoy starting people on that journey. If they're into runners and assessing runners, it's important to emphasize those different areas that they need to be, you know, experienced and skilled in. And especially in the early days, if they're not experienced in a certain part of that or a certain component of that, then liaising and linking up with people that can help, mentor, you know, cross refer as well.
Maybe one of the key questions you also can ask in your patient's history is also what has changed, you know? And then you sometimes the answer to that question will sometimes direct you already in a certain direction for your clinical examination. What has changed? Maybe the patient has changed his or her running technique based on what they read on the internet. That's also often the case. Sometimes I come in, I don't know anymore how to run because my friend says I have to run my forefoot. My neighbor, he's telling me I have to run a minimalistic shoe, etc. Now I don't know anymore how to run. These patients you also have. That's sometimes really interesting to see these kind of patients also coming in. But we have to remember a patient also thinks about his or her problem. And patients are not stupid. So we have to think and to listen to the patient. And often the solution is already in the story of the patient. If you listen very well, if you have a good background of all the aspects we covered today, then if you combine that with clinical experience, then you are already often in the right direction.
Yeah, it just highlights the absolute importance of a good subjective exam, which we've talked about on the podcast numerous times about other body parts, but it is really it's massive. We've talked about being the most important thing and the thing that guides what you're going to do from an objective point of view. And I think when you do your objective and say you are looking at strength markers, the other thing that I find interesting is that sometimes, and we talked to Greg about this because we talked to Greg about strength and conditioning. And it's always fascinating as well with the studies that look at people getting strong. So for example, you find some weakness in a certain, you know, muscle group, etc. And then people undergo strength training. And even people who objectively are no stronger after 6 weeks or however long often have reduced their pain. So it then becomes a question of, did their pain go down because you've strengthened up the calf and the hamstring and the glutes, for example? Was it the actual, because they are physically stronger, or was it just the act of doing strength training, which gives them that effort, self-efficacy? It gives them that confidence in their ability that, you know, they psychologically they're doing something about their problem. And very difficult to know that, but it's always fascinating but I think also what I think you do get from that is buy-in from the patients, because if you can show them, look, you know, your calf is weak and this is the exercise we're going to do to strengthen your calf, which often, as you know, is the same, you know, you do a single leg calf raise on the good leg. Oh, you can do 15 on that side. You can only do 5 on this side. So obviously there's a bit of a weakness there. You know, you've got an Achilles problem. Stands to reason that if we can strengthen this up, and it just makes sense to patients. So even though I know from some of the studies that I can't, from a physio head on, I can't say it's because they're getting stronger that the pain is going down. What I can say is that the patient gets good buy-in from that, and then doing their exercises makes sense. So there's often more compliance. So it's things like that, I think, that we don't always have to know exactly why things are working and getting the pain to reduce to actually still make a good clinically reasoned, you know, argument for why you're giving someone some strength training of, you know, in whatever body part that might be, if that makes sense.
I totally agree, Chris. I think that's a very important point. When we do interventions and we see a certain outcome, we don't know whether it's because of the intervention. That's the first point, that pain or symptoms have been improved. Or the second point, what has been the mechanism? Maybe if strength has increased, as you mentioned, is it because the strength has increased that the pain has improved? If you would think only very shortly about it, you would think, yes, that's because the strength has increased. But as you mentioned, there are also others who didn't increase their strength, for example, and also improved. And I think technically, no matter what population we are dealing with, if we are talking about knee osteoarthritis or low back pain or running injuries, whatever, we do different interventions with patients. But the mechanism behind the improvements is mostly not known. Even though the patient will improve, is it maybe because of natural history? Maybe. Is it really because of intervention? Maybe because of other factors, as you mentioned. Maybe the patient has more self-efficacy, more confidence. Maybe the patient has a clear understanding now, or at least another person has given or has provided a clear explanation of some symptoms that were really unclear to that person for a long time before, and really has confidence in you as a physical therapist. Maybe yes, and the first to admit that. And there are always people who say, this is my intervention, this is the reason why patients will improve, but I think that's too simplistic. And I agree with you, Chris.
Yeah, and the other thing that I wanted to mention or talk about, go more into the kind of loading side of things, as it were, Because obviously we've talked about loading quite a bit on the podcast today, and how it is important, and obviously a big thing is how quickly you increase your load. And I read another paper that Glenn sent me through actually before today was a paper with Gabbett, and I think you were a co-author on that paper. But it was basically about load management, and I thought it was really interesting. There was three main key points it talked about in the paper, and it was kind of to do with local tissue loading versus kind of sport specific loading, local loading, sport specific loading, and then also about self-reporting. So the patient's actually reporting, not only tracking the load in terms of what you think the load should be, but also the patient's letting you know and self-reporting an RPE and actually saying, you know, how they feel during that process. But it was fascinating in terms of I was saying to Glenn before the call about the local tissue loading. So the example it gives in the paper is if someone does too much local tissue loading but not enough sport specific loading, that would be like Nordic hamstring curls all the time but never sprinting, and then obviously getting injured when you sprint. And the reverse of that would be too much sport specific and not enough local tissue, which would be in the paper, I think it was a baseball pitcher throwing a baseball loads, so doing loads of pitching but never working any local tissue external rotation strength. And I quite like that way of thinking about it. I think it probably feeds into my biases, but it just in terms of doing some strength and conditioning work which does locally load the tissues, and then also thinking about you do need to load it in a sport specific manner as well.
Yeah, I think we are while working on that paper, we had really interesting discussions with Tim, with also Rich Willey and Igor Sancho. So what's maybe also a very important message of that paper is that when you consider the kinetics, for example, when you consider a load or load reads or whatever you call it, this is not the same as having an idea of the structure-specific load. Huh? So if you have an idea on the amount of ground reaction force, then you still don't have an idea on the specific loading and the rate of loading on a certain tendon or on a bone, etc. So that's important to understand. And very important to understand that even the kinematics are even further of that measure. Okay. So structure-specific loading is not the same as total loading. Okay. That's one thing. And indeed, for training, there are some specific guidelines. I would say it not really focused as a guideline, but more as a distinction between specific capacity and local tissue capacity, as you just mentioned, that often I think the local tissue capacity is a little bit neglected. For example, this morning I had an interesting discussion with a athletic trainer of a certain athlete who was really arguing that he was doing a lot of calf work but never isolated soleus strength. And I mentioned, based on the screening I did with that athlete, maybe it could be of interest to focus also on isolated strength for that muscle, because you do a lot of work, you do a lot of things, but in his perspective, it should always be like integrating in the chain, etc. But the thing is, when you really want to improve local tissue capacity for a tendon or a specific muscle, my advice would be to make as simple as possible, to make it as isolated as possible in the first place. The same for ACLs. If you want to make strong quadriceps muscles, you want to go to isolated strength training. Yeah, you want to go to leg extensions, for example. Brilliant exercise. To isolate your quads and to specifically work on the muscle that's typically weak. And then, of course, you progress towards integration into specific capacity. But I think we don't have to, and that's also what we mentioned in the paper, to swing the pendulum towards one or the other side too far. At the end, you want the combination. But again, there it's based on the presentation to see what the athlete probably needs to do. But I think it was good to show the readers that you have different kind of presentations. Therefore, we also made that quadrant, you know, in the paper with the four possible combinations of low and high specific capacity and local tissue capacity.
And it obviously kind of fits in more with that, and it talked about in the paper, that in the rehabilitation phase, you are doing more of that local tissue capacity because you're kind of, you are injured. So you are essentially building that tissue capacity back up to the point where it then can withstand higher loads, which obviously in sports specific activities, generally speaking, they're going to be more, you know, higher loads, higher speeds normally as well. So the forces going through are going to be more challenging than more of your isolated work. And I've always been a big fan of doing a mixture of isolated stuff. I know when back in the day when the functional training thing first came out, and I, you know, a huge fan of functional training, but I think it's, again, it's just, it's exactly what you said earlier, Bart, in terms of the black and white thinking. It's just, you just don't need to think black and white, because it's like the classic Nordics for hamstring injuries. Well, Nordics not really a sport specific exercise, but yet it has quite good evidence for reducing hamstring injuries. So it's one of those where, yes, of course, you need to do sprinting as well, and you need to work into getting back into football, because obviously a lot of that research has been done in, I think it was Denmark, with the footballers that they've done it with. But ultimately, it's a mixture of the two. And actually, often as well, with isolated stuff, you can load it heavier. So especially to begin with as well, because you haven't got that instability that you often get with sort of more functional exercises. So for example, with your ACL example, a leg extension, you can, you know, it's pretty simple exercise to do. You can load that, you know, obviously appropriately, but you can then load it to the point where someone can fatigue at, whether it be 6 reps, 8 reps, 10 reps. And actually it's a pretty safe exercise to do if you do it under control. You know, you only have to be shown how to do it probably once, and you know what to do with it, and you know how to do it. So I think that's where isolation exercise to get that local tissue capacity can be really useful. And I think we need to not poo-poo those exercises just because they're, you know, isolation exercises sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. The good thing is also that you know what you're doing, because if you have like whole body like control exercises, you don't really know where the load is going exactly. So for example, take the example of the leg extension, you can fairly easily monitor the load you apply there and to build upon the capacity there over there. While if you do directly bigger movements, you often don't really know what is actually going on in your quads at the end. Mostly not so much. So if you want really the loads and really high loads on specific tissue, it could be, especially in muscles who are relatively weak, then it could be a very good idea to work in isolation on that muscle, especially in the early and mid phases of rehab. Okay.
Definitely. Yeah, I think the squat's a great example of that, isn't it? You see, like, particularly post ACL, I've seen research that's showing that even in, you know, high level athletes, 6 months after their surgery, they're still asymmetrically loading on a squat. They're still leaning to the non-operated leg, you know, so that's a pattern you see more often than not.
We have two big compensations over there. That's not only with ACLs, but I could generally say most post-operative patients. Of course, most research has been done in ACLs, but two main compensations, which is, as you mentioned, interlimb compensations. So the non-injured limb is loaded more, the injured limb less, that's clear. But also intralimb compensations. And typically loading more to the hip and loading less to the knee. So at the end, as I just mentioned, what is the final loading to the quads? If you take already more than, for example, 60% on the other limb, and also more on the hip, but finally the question is, what's actually going on in my quad? And that's mostly not so much. And then they continue to do these exercises even for years sometimes, and they still find, wow, Bart, how is it now possible that my quad is still like this tiny muscle here? And then I have to say, maybe you have to think about how you train your quads first, before you start continuing doing these kind of compensations.
Definitely. Cool. Well, in terms of running related injuries, Bart, is there anything else that you would sort of any sort of key? I mean, I think you've mentioned a lot of the really key points with regards to the things we talked about already. But, you know, as a final sort of final thing, is there anything that you would want to sort of let physios know, or any key things that you look at when you're looking at just the running injury in general?
Well, I think the main message has been said, I think, to look at with a big picture view at our patients. That's maybe the main topic of today, or the main take home message of today, to not only look at mechanics, but also when you look at mechanics, for example, to really understand running mechanics. That might sound maybe simplistic, but That's the truth. So just looking at a certain angle of one body part while neglecting also the other body parts. For example, if you just look at that foot and ankle, tibia and foot inclination, as I just mentioned, I know that was in a study, but of course there are also other body parts that could also be relevant, which we didn't even include in that paper. For example, the trunk position, typically what I see clinically a lot with patients with anterior tibial overuse or tibialis anterior tendinopathy, etc. So the anterior biomechanical overload of the chin. Well, typically that's also what Andy Franklin Miller has been mentioned in his papers. Typically, they tend to use a pattern with indeed that overstride, that foot inclination, tibial inclination, but also with that trunk forward inclination. So they put the load more and more to that anterior part of the lower leg. So that's one pattern or one example where we might have to think about, okay, it's not only about one angle, it's not only about one point in time, it's about the whole body configuration. And that's the same for jumping, it's the same for cutting. We for example, in cutting and jumping, also in ACLs, we see more and more research now that it's about whole body positioning, how we transfer the force from the ground towards the next step, etc. Also in sprinting. So it's really about whole body positioning, and it's also there a kind of a technique for an athlete, but also a skill for a clinician to assess these patterns. And just what I want to mention here is try to avoid these oversimplistic first evaluations, but also the oversimplistic clinical reasoning. And so that's what I really, especially when I read on social media, these debates sometimes, it's so oversimplistic sometimes that I don't even want to react on these statements sometimes, that this doesn't matter, does not matter, because one study has found hip adduction, one study has found this. It's a little bit oversimplification in my point of view. So again, black and white, maybe not for today.
Definitely. Yeah, Glenn, did you have any final thoughts on?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think, like, for aspiring clinicians that are looking to develop their running assessment skills a little bit more, I think Bart's paper is a great resource to refer to look at what would be a good setup and a good way to start to analyze and look into their patterns and movement from a standard clinic, you know. So running machine, iPad, you know, some sensors. It's something that we could all implement if we're seeing runners as a big part of our caseload. So I thought that was a really important part to draw attention to as well.
Yeah. And I think, from my point of view, I think it's very similar to what you both said. It's just getting that full picture. And I think you just do learn over time. It's just that clinical puzzle, isn't it? It's just putting those pieces together. It's listening to the subjective. It's looking at the objective, looking at how they run, doing strength testing, mm-hmm. doing all these things, and then putting that all together. in a way that clinically reasons what you think is going on and then what you're going to do about it. And ultimately, like we talked about earlier, what you then do about it, we don't fully understand often why these things work. But if you can clinically reason through why you're doing something, I think often that's all we can do. And then we implement that. And ultimately, most of our patients, when you do that, they do get better. And if they're not getting better, then you revisit it. You ask a senior clinician, you ask other people, you get other, you know, people involved in terms of the full healthcare package, whether that's orthopedics or whether it's other people. So it's getting that, you know, understanding that it doesn't have to be perfect all the time. But if you've got that good clinical reasoning base and you don't just look at it simplistically, I think that's the best you can do. And your patients are going to feel confident if you put it together in a coherent way. So I think that's kind of what I would sort of finish off with. And then, Bart, if people want to sort of look at your stuff, if they want to get in touch or look, you know, do you have a website? Do you have, you're on social media? Like, how can people get in touch with you?
Sure. I'm always happy if people want to reach out or something. So I have a website, www.bartdingenen. So it's my name, .com. www.bartdingenen.com is my website. On social media, it's at bartdingenen. It's also just my name on Instagram or Twitter. People can reach me there. So I'm always happy to answer questions or anything that would come to your mind after listening to this podcast. What could also be of interest for some people out there is for patients clinicians who are more in the field of ACL. I have my own online ACL treatment course in collaboration with PhysioTutors, which is also on the website of PhysioTutors. I've been working on that more than over a year. It's really, really big. It's more than 40 hours of content. The good thing is that you can learn there wherever or whenever you want. And it's lifetime access. So once you have it, you keep having it, and I will update it. So I think it's not because it's mine, but I think it's really a good resource if you want to keep up to date and have a full picture of ACL rehab over there. That's also a good resource. All right.
I can personally vouch for you there, Bart, as well. I mean, we met in was it in Belgium when we met?
Yeah, it was in Belgium. Yeah. Yeah.
And I was 5-6 months post ACL. So I was picking your brains throughout the whole 2 days.
I bet you were loving it.
Yeah, absolutely loving it. So you gave me some fantastic guidance and advice there to help with my own rehab. It's often hard to manage your own conditions, right? So
But anyway, it's hard that we have, you know, this rehab process would take really a long time. Also there, the same as running, but also there, there are so many factors involved. So it's good to have a clear structure to know what and what you have to pay attention to, etc. And it's not easy to do it right. So I think definitely also based on the feedback I currently have of the online, but also of the offline courses. Yes, I mean, feedback is currently really exciting. So it's always very rewarding if you can help people to improve their clinical practice. Mm.
Another podcast there.
I was just about to say, yeah, it might be nice to get you back on at some stage and do an ACL one, because that would be fascinating. I had my ACL repaired from football. Okay. I played football when I was younger, so I had mine done when I was early 20s. Ended up getting a Cyclops lesion, so I had to have another arthroscopy about 8 months later, and so had a few issues there, and I played hockey to a high level, so that was my sport at the time. And I didn't play hockey because it was annoying, actually, because I did it playing football with my mates, just five aside on AstroTurf, but hockey was my actual main sport. So it was like I did it playing a sport that's not even my main sport. So it was really annoying. But me and Glenn have chatted a lot about ACLs, and coming back from my injury was, because I was playing hockey at that level, very frustrating, because I you know, I probably had, because of the cycle season, I was probably out for 18 months in the end, where I didn't play high level sport for 18 months, because for 8 months I couldn't fully extend. It was a crazy situation where this cycle lesion, you know, you just realize as a patient as well, how if you can't get full extension, your quad is just not going to work. Like, it's just not going to do well. I could not extend my leg. I went in and saw a guy, Di Reese, I think his name was, a consultant in the UK. He's retired now, but he used to do a lot of the players for Man City and things like that. He was up in Shropshire way. And he did an arthroscopy, took out the cycle lesion, and literally I came round, and after the arthroscopy, I was walking more comfortably and better the day, like a minute after having it done, than I was before I went in. Could fully extend, my quad worked straight away, and it was just crazy how much of a difference it made. So yeah, I think a chat about ACLs could be an interesting one, because yeah, they're a fascinating injury, but like you say, there's a lot of complexities, and we know there's lots of obviously psychological issues with that in terms of getting back to sport and stuff. Absolutely. Like that. So yeah, I don't want to go into it too much, because obviously it's we could talk for ages. So So fine. I just wanted to say, yeah, thank you so much for coming on, Bart. It's been really fascinating. And like I say, if we can get you back on again at some point for the ACL one, that would be great.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you again, Chris and Glenn, for the invitation. And it was my big pleasure here to share some ideas.
Hopefully you enjoyed that one, guys. I really, really enjoyed talking to Bart, and I thought it was absolutely fascinating. If running is your thing, then please go and check out Glenn's free course on running. It's over at the website physioacademycourses.co.uk, completely free, and the content is absolutely amazing. Go and check that out. Also, check out the Physio Plus Fitness YouTube channel. We've got loads of interesting content going on over there at the moment. And if you're liking these podcasts, I would love it if you could give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform. It just means that the podcast gets promoted to more people, and we get the message out there and hopefully educate and entertain more people. That's all for us today, guys, and we will see you on the next one.